Sorry, I'm late too. I had a cat vomit incident.
Who doesn't these days? Who doesn't? Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm Ian Mond. This is Kirsten McDermott. And Kirsten, this is our final episode, possibly forever. There we go. I've said it.
I like how you said possibly. Isn't it definitely?
Yeah, it's pretty close to definite. I mean, it would require
a ton of money.
An arm twisting.
And someone else to produce it with a studio. I think that's what it would require.
Yeah, actually, let's go with that. Yes.
Someone else with a studio to produce it, and all we do is rock up once a month and record for 90 minutes.
Correct.
That's it.
That would be great.
What you do. Like, that's all you do.
Yes. No. Okay. True.
It would be no change for you, actually. So I don't know why you'd be so interested.
No, it would. It would, because I'd have to go to a studio and it would be all professional done. And it's not my son's bedroom.
Are you calling me unprofessional?
No, for fuck's sakes. Anyway. Look,
you'll miss this.
No, I won't. I'll miss some of it.
Yes.
Life has gotten too difficult. Let's just put it that way.
Life has gotten difficult, and the incident that happened last month where we lost our recording of what, honestly, and I don't think this is just rose-tinted memory glasses, but I do think it was one of the best episodes we'd done.
It was. Recently. I'm still devo. I'm genuinely still devo.
So that was, and then just looking around and finding a new provider and just it's fine. Like, we can definitely do it if we wanted to, but it just made us rethink how much this is impacting our lives and how difficult it is actually becoming to get the time to read and record. So we are going out before we wither on the vine.
Correct. Correct. So I think we should briefly speak about the Lost podcast, not about the pain of it, but the books.
the pain. Oh, that week of back and forth going, are you sure, provider? You can't capture it because you said it was being continually uploaded the whole time. And also you said that it was on our hard drives and doesn't appear to be. And they're like, well, yeah, no, that's not how we do it anymore. And it doesn't appear to have been captured in our stuff. So no podcast for you. It's like, oh.
It makes me furious.
It makes me so angry. But let us recap though, because I think we had two books that that we did talk about for close to 2 hours. And they were Monsters by Emerald Fennell and A Helping Hand by Celia Dale. And we're not going to do another 90 minutes on these two books, listeners, but we did both really like them. Ian, what did you think of – I think we talked about Monsters first.
I really liked Monsters. I feel it has a stronger first half than second half. That was my memory of what I said and still my memory now. A little bit disappointed by the end. I think that was a unanimous view of both of us.
Yeah, I felt the – without spoiling anything, the ending kind of undermined the magnificent character work that Emerald Fennell did with her unnamed protagonist. I loved that character so much. I loved what Fennell was doing. This was a character who is a 10-year-old girl and just a wonderfully complex and nuanced depiction of this 10-year-old girl with some non-mainstream interests in her life. And it was just wonderful. It was so beautiful. And for me, the specific ending, the last chapter, undermined that characterization. But otherwise, I really, really enjoyed reading this book.
I loved the moment that she tells us that her parents died on the cruise ship, having been one of I think the mother goes overboard, the father follows, and they get smooshed by the blades.
And I think smooshed might be the word that's used as well.
Yeah.
Or some word like that.
Exactly.
She's a great character. And I did read some reviews at the time which were talking about her as like, oh, she's sociopathic. It's like, for this reader, unless I'm sociopathic, I didn't think she was, but it was interesting actually to read those kind of reviews and go, huh. So if you have a female character, maybe especially a girl, who's not showing really explicit and ongoing caregiving and empathy and all of that. She's sociopathic. And it's like, I mean, the little boy who's her, who becomes her best friend and leads her, well, doesn't lead her. They both together wander down difficult
some dark paths.
But he certainly nudges her into worse directions than she would have taken on her own. He feels you could very clearly make a literary argument that that is a little sociopath in the making. But I didn't get that from her. I thought she was a fantastic character who's also, she's had so much trauma happen to her. She deflects a lot of it with graveyard humor, and she's also very shut down. She's built these emotional walls within herself as protection. And it's really interesting to see how that can be read by some people as psychopathy rather than post-traumatic stress protections that she's erected for herself. But
and you can see from reading the book where Saltburn and Promising Young Woman comes
from. You can absolutely see that. It is a good book. As I said, we both felt a little let down by the actual ending, like the last chapter. But it's, highly recommend. Really good book.
A book that did not let us down at all. And this is actually the real reason why I'm devastated about the podcast.
Yes.
This is possibly one of the best books we've read for the 104 episodes.
Possibly.
It's right. I'd say
it's in the top 10.
Easily.
It would be top 10.
And that's Celia Dale's A Helping Hand. And look, I don't know how I start talking about it without us just doing another hour and a half because it's...
We'll have to restrain ourselves. I think the great tragedy, and I talked about a little bit about this in the podcast, was we chose this book, or you chose this book, Ian, because Ben Peake, an Australian author, mentioned it on Facebook as a book he'd read and it sounded interesting. I'd also read the Facebook review that Ben had done. Well, not really a review, just like a few words that he'd said, and I was thinking, I'd like to read the book. And the next minute, Ian's messaging me going, Celia Dale, I'm going to do Helping Hand for the podcast. It's like, okay, cool. I want to read that. I saw Ben's post. And I had just thought because I hadn't heard of Celia Dale, and I had just assumed from the context of what the book was about, this was just set in the 1960s, but that this was a more contemporary novel, because this is one that has been re-released recently, so it's got quite a contemporary looking cover. It's actually Celia Dale was writing all the way through to the 80s, actually, but the books which seem to have got the most minimal as it is traction, ones that she wrote in the 60s and 70s, and it is just, I cannot believe that Celia Dale isn't talked about in the same way we talk about Shirley Jackson and Agatha Christie and
Patricia Highsmith
and these authors who were women who wrote these amazing books and have their legacy has continued, especially as Celia Dale continued publishing into the 1980s. Such a tragedy, because A Helping Hand is, it's a phenomenal book. It's about elder abuse and exploitation and the banality of evil. I don't think I've ever seen a better fictional example of the banality of evil, as this book,
written in the most icy but pointed prose, mm-hmm. that really gets under your skin. It's just extraordinary.
Like Emerald Fennell's book, really, these little bits of black humor all the way through it. Monsters is written in first person from the unnamed narrator. A Helping Hand is third person, and it's not third person direct, but it occupies a lot of the mind space of our two main characters, who are a husband and wife, who take elderly ladies into their home and slowly wither them down to death and take all their money, which is a lot of money as well. It's not even like what they're doing. They're not getting millions of dollars. They're getting people's pensions and what little amounts of money they may have when they die, because they make them sign their wills over and everything. But we're not.
They could get the same amount of money just getting jobs.
Exactly. We're not talking about the phrase Australians like to do is, we're not playing for sheep stations here. You know, it's these horrible, like genuinely evil crimes that they're doing for so little monetary reward. But I think there's an additional factor of the emotional rewards they're getting, because the woman especially seems quite, there's a low-key sadism running through Her actions.
I just want to ask you something.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, what did you think of Josh's scrapbook?
Josh's scrapbook. Oh, yeah, he's awful. Like, they're both awful. It's Josh's scrapbook doesn't stick in my mind.
Oh, so really? Much. That's the thing. It does,
but not as much as that scene in the hotel room with the maid.
Oh, that okay, that, fine.
That's
yes,
like dial it up to 11. Ick in such yeah. a. And this is the brilliance of Celia Dale. She gives you these emotional effects with these small, mundane, banal details.
Oh.
And this incident in the hotel room really was this thing which probably happens every day, unfortunately, to female hotel workers and some male hotel workers too, I'm sure, where, you know, that she's basically sexually assaulted by a guest. And I really hate talking about gradations of sexual assault, but what he did, he put his hand up her skirt and grabbed her, which is awful. Yeah. But it didn't go further than that. And Celia Dale, just because of the way he thinks about it and what he did and what he thinks afterwards, it, as I said, the level of ick is like 11 out of 10. It's just so and she has that throughout the book. They just do these things to this poor
go
woman.
Go look at the original cover, not the cover that's now there, but just do a Google search. It's one of the best covers.
Yeah, it's a really good cover. I think that's the cover I may have put up on our show notes, actually.
Okay, cool. All right, excellent.
Oh, which aren't there because it's the cover I had prepared to put up on our show notes. I'm going to put them up in this one as well. So I'll put those two up. But yes, it's such a good book. I'm definitely going to read more Celia Dale. Happily. And this sounds a little bit silly, but one of the reasons, and Ian and I, just for some background, we did try to record this podcast last week and Ian had internet trouble, and it's just fortunate we both had to a week later able to do it, because often we don't. I'd actually had something cancelled today or I wouldn't have been able to do it. Just one of the extra things is like, oh my God, we can't keep going. So we very spontaneously just said, you know what, let's do one more episode and stop. And over the intervening week, I was saying to my partner, Jason, I'm actually like, it was like a decision. We just made it spur of the moment, but I'm actually really quite relieved. And one of the things I'm looking forward to is being able to read, because my reading time these days is so limited. And I'm looking forward to be able to read books by authors we've done on the podcast already. Because it sounds silly, but so many times I've got these books stacked up and it's like, oh, I want to read this book. I'm lucky if I get another book read outside the podcast books each month. So I'm looking at, you know, two podcast books and one other book if I'm lucky. And it's like, well, I can't make this a podcast book because we already talked about this author in a previous episode and we want to try to keep expanding the authors and not just going back and doing two or three or four podcasts about the same author. So it's like I get to read all those books now by authors like Karen Warren and Angela Slater and Stephen King and, you know, the books that I just have been buying and they're sitting there and it's like I just haven't had time to read them. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And I now intend to actually read some more Celia Dale's. I bought the – can't remember the name, but I bought the other – her what is clearly considered her other major work.
The one with the word sheep in it? Sheep's clothing or something?
Yes, that's – yeah, about the two sisters who were
– yeah.
So that is on my Kindle and I'll be looking forward to reading that. such a good author. If you've not heard of her like me, go search her out. I believe a lot of her books are out of print and you can probably just track them down through secondhand bookshops or, you know, online secondhand book exchanges and so on. But there are a handful in print and she's just an astonishing author. I cannot believe she's not as well known as Shirley Jackson. She's so good, so good. And Patricia Highsmith.
Okay.
So that was a very, yes, very, very brief summary of the fabled lost episode, which I know in our heads now, like I'm going to be on my deathbed going, that episode that was lost was the best podcast episode there ever was of any podcast ever in the world. It's a global tragedy that it was, oh my God, it's going to have just built up in our heads now. But it was a really good episode.
It is a global tragedy. 100% is. Anyway.
So moving on, I guess, to the books that we plan to talk about this month, which is The Glutton by A.K. Blakemore, that Ian chose, and Days of Innocence and Wonder by Lucy Trelaw, which was my choice. So, Ian, we might as well start with The Glutton. Why did you choose this book?
Oh,
I'm always interested in that.
Because it had been getting a lot of talk on the places that I look at things. A lot of people.
Listeners, none of you are unhappy with Stoffy, are you? We've already begun to wither on the vine.
I know. It's very bad. Look, I was all pepped up like goofballs to discuss this last week. Now,
I know. Well, that's the thing. It's like a lost podcast, delayed podcast. Like we. Oh, anyway, why did you choose The Glutton? You read reviews of it.
Correct. No, it seemed to be a book that a lot of people really, really enjoyed,
and this is the second novel.
Yes.
And her first novel was very well received.
Yes, exactly. The Manning Tree Witches, which I will eventually pick up. Mm-hmm. I had reservations about this novel, but that the key thing that I loved about this novel is the reason I'm going to pick up The Manning Tree Witches. But, yeah, no, it seemed interesting, and there was a lot of talk about 6 to 8 months on it. And so, as usual, I bought it, mm-hmm. but then it's now been sitting on my Kindle. As usual. One of the things that will be missed from this podcast, although I suppose I can just do it normally, is I used this podcast to read books that I'd forgotten to get around to. But I suppose I could just do that, couldn't I? I don't need the justification of a 2-hour podcast.
Just do that. And you write your reviews on your now resurrected blog. Are you still calling it the Historical Hamster?
Yeah, I may rename it. But yeah, I will
put the link to that in the show notes, listeners, so you can.
I haven't published anything for the last 2 weeks because I've been very, very busy, which, again, another reason why we're not doing more podcasts. but the blog is going to be my new place where I do it already on Facebook and Twitter. On Blue Sky. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll put a link to Ian's blog in the show notes, and I'll put a link to my website, although I rarely
post. No, but mine will get updated at least 3 times a week.
And Ian will continue to post his reviews. So if you are missing Ian's erudite commentary on contemporary literary fiction, that was the wrong thing to say. I don't care anymore. This is our last episode.
You can read his blog. It's fine. Just note that. Kirsten was complimenting me there, which is really nice, and I'm red in the face, but then just trailed off as if act of complimenting me was made her nauseous.
What it was that I said contemporary literary fiction, meaning just, you know, literature, but these days literary fiction is, of course, a genre, and Ian is not going to just talk about literary fiction as a genre. He'll be talking about all sorts of genres on his blog. And
I'm not bound by genre.
All I meant to say. He is not bound by genre.
So
The Glutton.
Yes, anyway.
What did you think?
What did I say to you on text?
Oh, over text? Let me. What you said was... I didn't love The Glutton. I liked it. Spoiler, I liked it more than the other book we're going to discuss on this podcast because it's more my thing, but it's empty calories, which is rather ironic.
Yes, because it's about an actual person. This is, although I wouldn't, it's historical fiction, but with a big skew towards the fable element. But anyway, a real person, and I'm going to missay their name. I'm saying Tarare.
I looked up a pronunciation, and there were a couple of the documented historical figure who's only documented in one contemporaneous medical paper.
Correct.
It's spelt slightly differently. So
it's got two R's.
Depending on which one you put into Google to get a pronunciation. But the one I was kind of landed on and had in my head all the way through was sort of just Tarare.
So Tarare.
But it's not quite the. I know anyone who's speaking French, I apologize. I've butchered that pronunciation, but it was a difficult one to get my tongue around.
So Tarare was a real person, as Kirsten just said, documented in a medical journal in, I think, around 1815. Mm. But he lived around just before the turn of the 18th century. And a lot of the events for this occur in the lead up to the French Revolution.
Yes.
Thereabouts. And anyway, Tarare was known, apparently, at the time for his appetite, a ravenous appetite. But it wasn't that he was hungry. This is the key. He just could eat and eat and eat and it's like this empty. He just could never fill himself up. So it wasn't. It's not a hunger in the way that we experience it. It was. It's more just this hole that he needed to constantly fill, and he could fill.
You're talking about the character.
Well, so this is the thing. Okay. Blakemore has heavily leant on the medical record and what's known. So a lot of the events that happened in the novel did actually happen to Terre in the real world, as far as we know, based on the medical journal. So if we're to take the medical journal face value, then yes.
Which I think you need to take the article with several grains of salt.
Do you?
I think you do. Don't forget Terre, like the historical figure. He also did this as his way of earning a living
for a period, as in the novel. I mean, there's several departures that Blakemore makes. Yeah. The biggest actually is his childhood, because there was clearly not a lot of information.
Yeah. No, that is quite imagined. And I guess the inciting incident, the explanation for his hunger.
So in the medical journal, his hunger is the thing that he was born with.
Yeah. He's always had it.
In the novel, there's an inciting incident that for whatever reason gives him this problem.
Yeah. He's almost killed.
Yeah.
Left for dead. And when he emerges, he has this insatiable hunger.
This is exactly. And so how insatiable it was. Again, though, the bit in the book where he eats 75 eggs, is it, or and then a banquet, that's the medical journal. Because taking it with the grains of salt that you said, if the historical Terre was a real person.
Oh, I think he was a real person.
Okay, well, that's what Blakemore's worked off, okay? So, this is terrific. Anywho, let me read the back cover blurb.
Yes, let's do that.
Before we get any further, okay? So I'm going to go. It's a subversive historical novel, Kirsten. That's what I want you to know straight off the bat. Okay. 1798 France. Nuns move along the dark corridors of a Versailles hospital with a young sister, Perpetua, has been tasked with sitting with a patient who must always be watched. The man, gaunt, with his sallow skin and distended belly, is dying. They say he ate a golden fork and that it's killing him from the inside. But that's not all. He is rumoured to have done monstrous things in his attempts to sate an insatiable appetite. An appetite, they say, tortures him still. Born in an impoverished village to a widowed young mother, Terre was once overflowing with quiet affection for the baby Jesus and many saints, for his mother, for the plants and little creatures in the woods and fields around their house. He spends his days alone observing the delicate charms of the countryside. But his world is not a gentle one, and soon, life as he knew it, is violently upended. Terre is pitched down a chaotic path through revolutionary France, left to the mercy of strangers and increasingly bottomlessly ravenous.
That's a good précis.
No, it's really good. It's really good, and it tells you all you need to know, and it doesn't give you the specific details that we're about to spoil. That's also good.
The framing narrative is Terre in the hospital at the end of in his last days.
Yes.
With this young nun, Perpetua, who is tasked in the evenings or overnight. I think it's overnight. She has the overnight watch on this patient who is dying, and also must be watched because he gets up to no good if he's not watched.
Correct.
And he's telling her his life story, and that is the bulk of the novel, but it is framed by this.
Is it though framed halfway through the novel?
Coming back to it.
Up until the halfway point, then we stop. Because he dies in the real. Yes, yes. So you know how you notice perspective jumps? That's your thing.
Yep.
I sometimes notice weird structural jumps.
And the
weird structural jump here is that the stuff with the nun occurs for about 60% of the novel. And then Terre dies in the hospital around 60% of the way
through. Does he? He doesn't die at the end.
No.
I've misremembered that.
And then for the last 40% of the novel, it's just told from his perspective, as if he's still speaking to her, even though he's actually dead. And then the next time we see the nun is when the doctor. It's not then the same name as the actual doctor who wrote the medical record. Blakemore changes the name, but when that doctor comes to the hospital to to essentially do an autopsy at the time. So that's the next time we see. We don't see the nun for like 40% of the novel.
I remember that these framing devices are quite short little interludes. Isn't that funny? I think in my head I've restructured it so that it's a bit more, so that it just ties up. Oh,
and it's funny. One of the weird oddities of this book. It's not a bad one. I'm not saying that's shit. It's just weird.
It is.
Why use a framing device?
That makes it slightly unbalanced.
Because the problem with the framing device, and I know I'm getting straight into the negatives, because I want to be clear, there are parts of this book I absolutely adored. Mm. But the problem with the framing device is that it gives us a Terreur who we never get throughout the novel. He's a lot nastier.
He is. Cruel,
and just awful. And yet the Terreur of the main flashback part of the novel, the bulk of the novel, is this sort of innocent without agency who's constantly being manipulated by others. And it's as if, I don't know, I mean, it's as if it's two different people. In fact, there's actually three or four different Terreurs in the book, which is partly my problem.
You can see where the present-day Terreur has come from. Like at some point, you can make the extrapolation that at some point he's finally gone, fuck this, fuck people. People are awful. I've just been exploited and manipulated my whole life, and that has finally broken him. But you're right. We never see that.
We never see it.
Even a small escalation of that. We never see Terreur that he's talking about in the past is always it's wide-eyed innocent. This young boy and then young man who is in deep physical and emotional pain.
Even the climactic bit with Terreur. In the past scenes, the climactic bit, which I won't spoil, is still the wide-eyed, innocent Terreur. And then if you then roll back to the beginning of the novel, which is obviously him towards his death, they're not the same. There's such a – and, yes, you're right, obviously shit happened in between, but there's no link between them. And this is just one of those disconnects that I found odd with the book that I'm not sure what that's trying to do. That's what I found it bewildering.
I'm going to admit to, and maybe one of the reasons the structure of it hasn't embedded itself in my memory is I will admit to not skimming, but reading very quickly through a lot of this novel.
Why, Kirsten? The language is beautiful. There is some
beautiful, but it's sort of it's funny that you messaged me with. It was like empty calories because it's like sitting down to a gigantic chocolate mud cake, fully iced and full of all of the stuff. And it's like, oh, my God, amazing. And then being told to eat it all at once. Like, it's too much. It's just too much. Doesn't matter how delicious a slice or two or maybe three of that chocolate mud cake is, if you're going to eat the whole cake at once, it's too much and you're going to feel a bit ill. And for me, the glutton is one of where there was just so much. It was just the constant of the same and the same. It's more chocolate mud cake. Oh, it's more chocolate mud cake. Yes, another slice of chocolate mud cake. And it just wasn't was not a book for me. And I kind of knew that about a third of the way in. And to be brutally honest, if it wasn't a podcast book, this is a book I would have abandoned.
So again,
because it's not a good book, not because some of the writing in this book is superb, but it's not my kind of book. And I was skating right off the top of it. And then that feeds into it as well, because it's then a book that I felt obligated to read. Then there's this resentment as I'm reading it.
Which is not good
and not fair to the book.
So I agree that the prose is dense isn't the right word, but
not just the prose, but all the stuff that's happening. There's so much repetition and re-embedding of what, like how Terreur is feeling and why he's feeling it and what people are doing to him. And it's a lot, which may be the point, but it's not a book I connected with on the level that I would like to connect.
So I think it's written the way it's written, if I had to take a punt, is that there's an attempt here, and I don't know how successful it is, to juxtapose beauty with revulsion. That to me is the whole point.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's not a particularly big revelation there, and no epiphanies there.
I think writing it in a way that for like the writing style itself, the words chosen, the sentence structure, the way, the poetic devices, all of that, absolutely beautiful, and for great chunks of the book describing really horrendous, repulsive things.
Yeah, and I feel like if I read a section of this book just now, everyone listening would go, "Wow,
wow!"
but when that's the tone the whole way through, you're right.
Chocolate
it does
mud cake.
Yeah, yeah. You're right, and but I get why. Look, I don't know. I mean, the thing that I found more fascinating about the book was actually researching Terreau, the real person.
Yeah.
And again, it comes to the choices that Blakemore makes in the novel, especially in terms of his childhood. I mean, so she's decided to, again, so what happens is that his mother, who Terreau is besotted with, in a way that has a sort of hint of incest to it, but is never fully, you know, there's something going on there. So apparently hoarding salt was a big deal. And so the mother falls in with a guy and his partner who want to hide all this salt under their floorboards.
Because salt's hard to get to in pre-revolutionary France.
Correct. And he's a bit of a bastard. Shit happens. The salt gets stolen away by one of Therese's only friends and some
supposed friends.
A gang is with. And the father takes it out on Therese and belts the living daylight out of him.
The stepfather.
Takes him to the forest and absolutely belts the shit out of him. And leaves him for dead. And then Therese struggles to get to a pasture somewhere near cows. And I suppose the impression is maybe did a tapeworm go down his throat or something? Something happened that when he awakes.
Oh, I just took that as there's a a neurological injury that has just there is an actual medical condition where people don't have the switch in their brain to tell them that they're full. So people are perpetually hungry because they don't.
I understood that those people, and please correct me, put on weight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, there's something definitely like there's metaphysical stuff happening with Therese, definitely.
Because Therese doesn't put on weight. I mean, his belly is distended as if he's starving, but he doesn't.
Yeah. And the things that he eats, because it's not always food, seems to just vanish into a black hole that is inside him because he doesn't even, you know, they can give him emetics and he's not even crapping it all out. Like it just disappears. It disappears.
My question is, what's going on here? Why has Blakemore done this? Why not just tell the historical story? I mean, I'm not questioning that as if it's a bad thing. I'm just saying, we're always wondering when we're reading, why make this choice? And
it is significant choice, though, because when you step back and look at it, it is a difference between a person who is born the way they're born,
yep,
and a person who has had this inflicted upon them as an injury.
Yes, that is a big difference.
Different, especially in a book which a great part of it is a discussion about monstrosity and human evil and all of this stuff. And there is a huge difference between being born a particular way or suffering an injury. And we see that difference leveraged in various ways for good or ill, mostly for ill, in a lot of discussions these days around difference and monstrosity and disability and so on. So it's an interesting choice to make.
And in making that choice, because the book seems to often be about the characters that Therese meets, not about Therese. I mean, yes, we get into his mind, but you take, and I'm getting towards him, when he becomes the incompetent spy.
Mm. That's the bit I think I like the most. section with bringing in the historical figures of Napoleon and so on and sending this guy and just the farce that was that whole section was
and that is good, but
because there's different things, you know, and Therese's response was different.
But he goes off, but it's funny how when he goes to Prussia and he gets this and goes to this family, you understand the family is who you're thinking about. Therese just seems to be this cipher throughout the whole novel. He's, even though, you know, they figure out pretty quick there's something not right about this bloke, and then they dob him in because it's, you know, they have to. I mean, if they don't, if they hoard him away, that's going to be an issue. for them. They could lose their lives. Yeah. So they've dug them in. And you feel for them and sympathy for them, but Terreur is just this blank.
Yeah.
And that's my problem. Blakemore doesn't give Terreur agency at all, really, in the novel until his deathbed, and then he's just cruel. He's just nasty.
Yeah, it's not even – I mean, you're right. There's definitely a lack of agency. He is, like, bounced around the place like a pinball. But it's not just that. It's the fact that he just has this almost single emotional valence throughout the whole book. And that's the issue for me. I think that's why he's a bit, as you say, a bit of a cipher, because this is just – he's like almost like a wind-up toy. It's like put him in this situation, turn him on, this is how he'll react. And, yes, he's got this overwhelming physically and cognitively painful hunger, and that is going to dominate his every waking moment. But there wasn't enough nuance in that.
No, and when he's being experimented on by the doctors,
yeah,
you feel for Terreur, but only because he's a human going through pain.
Yeah.
Like you would any human going through pain. Well, being tortured. I mean, any person being tortured, yeah, you feel some sympathy for, empathy for. And I just that was my problem. He is the focus of the novel, but he isn't.
Yeah,
much. He isn't a fully fledged. He isn't his own person, and that's because he's a real. Because he was a person,
and that's
he
was a real and that's person. One of my things, because I didn't know any of that when I started reading the book. Right,
that he was that. This is based on historical.
This is a historical person.
Yeah,
that's something I found out. After I finished the book, I went sort of then looking and because I, you know, long-time listeners will know that I try not to find out too much about a book before I read it. I don't read reviews or anything like that. So it was only after I'd finished it that I was going around looking to see, you know, what other people's thoughts were about it and so on, and people were mentioning that it's based on this real character. So, oh, okay, well, I'll go and look up this person. And then it just made me a bit angry because if you've completely invented a fictional character, and maybe you've based them on things you know that are from real life, or maybe people you know, or history, whatever. But when you take a real person who lived, and you know, explicitly are just making a fictional interpretation of their life, I mean, there's stuff in the historical record that it's like, I mean, did he really eat a toddler? I don't know. I do highly doubt the historical figure ate a toddler. I think that's probably slander. But in the book, it's real. This is what he did. So you've taken this historical personage and you have in this book literally made a monster of him. You've made a monster of him in the exact same way that the people when he lived
made a monster of him. Correct. That's right.
But in your book, you've said this is what's actually happened. Not historically, but in the book, this is what has actually happened. It's not a horrible rumor someone started about this guy who must have eaten a child. No, it did happen. And I think we have to be very careful when we use real people in fiction explicitly.
I mean, he and his family are unlikely to sue, given it was three.
I'm not talking about being careful in a legal way. Yeah, there is a responsibility we owe to people. Fiction, whether it's written fiction or film or whatever it is going to remain in public consciousness a lot longer than actual historical fact. And it will, in many cases, overwrite historical fact like a palimpsest of some kind. And I think we have a responsibility as creators of fiction to avoid doing that to some extent, especially to someone who was clearly a marginalized person when he was alive.
And was treated abominably. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was something I didn't know the whole time I was reading it. And then retrospectively it's like, I'm not sure I'm okay with a lot of what happened in this novel now.
I mean, while I was sitting there thinking about this novel, and again, I love the stuff when he's with the group, the troop of thieves and whores.
as they call themselves, we should say.
Which I did enjoy. And again, because it's quite, there's some funny bits in that and that, but it's also pretty dark.
And it went on a little long for me, but yeah.
Yeah, well, clearly. The thing that, while I'm sitting there, though, as much as I enjoyed a section of the book, while I'm sitting there thinking about this book, it's set during the French Revolution because that's when he was born and that's when he lived. So there's this uneasy attempt to link Terreur with the revolution and the anarchy and the sense of instability and this whole idea of democracy and what democracy means with Terreur's own situation, but it never sort of
symbolically,
gels.
You mean?
Yeah, well, whether he is a metaphor for the all of France and what France is going through. I don't know. I mean, I just there's this uneasy friction. There's a lot of people talking to Thérèse about democracy and about why the revolution's going on, and Thérèse doesn't seem to give a shit. And so it's one of these things. You go, okay. What's going on?
It definitely feels like one of the, I guess, thematic concerns of the book is the idea that the French Revolution was something that the elites did and the common people didn't care about it because they're too busy being hungry and starving.
Yes, okay, yep.
Which maps to Thérèse quite easily, I think. And I think it's a very simplistic reading of what happened at that time in France.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, I think we've said a single nice thing about this book.
we've said, the writing itself on a sentence level is just gorgeous.
And if you read the reviews, of which I've now done, because it's been, feels like 6 months since I'd read this book, now the reviews, which are the things that got me to pick up the book, all point this out. So if you find this conversation to be unsatisfactory, because we've been quite negative, go read the reviews because they're reasonably, I think this got lots of plaudits and it was mostly to do with the prose. It was to do with
honestly, I'm reading the reviews, I'm thinking, I knew I'd missed something, right? Because I knew the book had been well received, and it's like, this is clearly just not a book for me. It's not a book for me. Oh,
but I thought the grotesqueries would be of interest to you.
As I said, eating a whole chocolate mud cake.
Okay. All right, so like I'm saying, if you feel like we've absolutely smashed this book into smithereens, go read the actual reviews by professionals. No, I'm a professional.
By professionals.
And I think you'll see a much more positive view of the book. And I agree with a chunk of what those reviews say. I wish more was done with Thérèse as a character, a person, as a human being.
Yeah. No, I think that's the big thing for me. I'm not going to fault the writing itself, but I need more. I need more. You can't just write it pretty and make me happy anymore.
So I don't mean to continue the negative vibe here, Kirsten.
Oh, well, that's
if right. If I wasn't reading Days of Innocence and Wonder for the podcast,
you would have stopped.
I probably would have finished it. But it would have been, well, it would have been with what I experienced, which is with gritted teeth.
Oh, dear. Let me read the back cover copy for Days of Innocence and Wonder by Lucy Trelaw. When someone is taken away, what is left behind? All her life, Till has lived in the shadow of the abduction of a childhood friend and her tormented wondering about whether she could have stopped it. When Till, now 23, senses danger approaching again, she flees her past and the hovering presence of her fearful parents. In Werriwee, a town on its knees, she stops and slowly begins creating a new life and home. But there is something menacing here too. Till must decide whether she can finally face down, even pursue the darkness, or whether she'll flee once more and never stop running. Which is, again, good summary.
Again, good summary. Good now, can I start with a positive? Can I start with a positive?
Go for it.
Trelaw nails Melbourne lockdown. Absolutely nails it. Gets it perfect. That's
which is all done in the memory of Till. That's all past.
Yes,
but yeah, it's all in the past. There's lots of like back.
If you're an international reader or someone in another state that is not Melbourne, Victoria, and you want to know what it was like existing in Melbourne during COVID and the lockdowns, this book is probably one of the best representations I've seen, in as much as what she says are things that I remember and experience. In fact, the fact that Till reads Daniel Defoe, the play, I was reading that too during lockdown.
I'd imagine quite a few people did.
Yeah. So
I should say this is not the focus. This is not a book about COVID and lockdown. Or anything. That's just context for what's happened in Till's immediate past.
Yeah, yes. I did want to say that. I wanted to – there's also – and as a side note, because this is a very – well, it's mostly set in South Australia, but Till is from Melbourne, Brunswick. Yep. So it's a very Melbourne book. There's a section in there about a tree on Flemington Road.
Yes.
That's removed.
Which is real.
That is real. Not only is it real – I remember getting emails on it for part of my work.
Yes, the removal and I thought of that tree was a
big... And I know why that tree was removed, which I get the sympathy the Trelaw was trying... Look, it was a very old tree. It was a beautiful tree. It was a lemon tree. But there was a reason why it was removed. There were road safety implications, but... Yeah, that gave me flashbacks too, and because it was a really different. I didn't remove the tree, by the way. I just
no one writes to Ian.
Yeah, exactly. I had nothing to. I was sort of tangentially involved, but I wasn't the perpetrator of the tree removal. I just remember very, very well. Again, it gave me weird flashbacks to work. So that was all. So it gave me flashbacks. This book to lockdown and to my work.
Nice.
Which is not what I was expecting going in. So, nice. But even that stuff was good. I like the Flemington tree stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't like much else, but that's...
No. I would say that I really loved most of this book. Funnily enough, I think this is a very similar reading experience for me in some respects as reading Monsters by Emerald Fennell, in that most of it I really loved. I was really absorbed, really engaged, and I felt let down by what happens near the end.
Okay, so
and I think we're going to spoil this book. We're going to have to spoil the book, really.
Well, we have to. There's yeah, got,
quite
we're
thoroughly.
It's funny because this book is the anti-glutton in that the language is extremely understated.
It's so elegant and so sparse, and I really, really loved it.
And because
I loved the writing.
And I've got to say, my head wasn't in the right space to read this book. And I did say this online, and this is true. This is not me trying to be kind to a book I didn't like. I genuinely was not in the right head space. Again, I've been very busy the last few weeks. And this was one of those books where the prose felt like soap, where I had to constantly go back. I lost it. Well, I had to constantly go back and go back to the start of the paragraph because I'd lost the thread. I kept losing the thread. Yeah. And if I maybe read it now, right now, because I'm in a better headspace now, I might enjoy it more. So I've got to caveat everything. The one problem I have with the book is not to do with my headspace, has to do with the genre elements.
It's almost like at about the – feels like more than halfway, but possibly not that much more than halfway. It is trying to become a different book.
No, I disagree. I don't think it is trying to be a different book. I think it's simply – the genre elements, the crime thriller elements, are essentially felt like an afterthought. That they're there to punctuate some of the quieter moments, to provide some tonal difference and to punctuate them, but that there's not much genuine thought being given to how they're going to connect all together. That's pretty rude, I know. But that's how it felt. So if we go back, and this is where we're going to spoil it, when she's five, Till and E, her best friend, are playing, and a man comes and absconds away with E.
Yeah.
And this traumatizes Till and will for the rest,
For the rest of her life. She's 23. She's got time to go to get to work this through this.
Yeah.
But yes.
A huge trauma, as it would be.
And it's massive. She's nonverbal for a while.
Yes,
she rejects her name. Like Till is not her name. Till is a name she has said at that age, and she now, when she does start talking again, what she now wants to be called.
And one of the things I really liked, at least unless I missed it, I don't think her real name's ever given.
It is.
Is it?
We'll get to that.
I missed it then.
At the very end.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yes, that annoyed me. That's right.
And annoyed me too.
That's right. That really shat me. Anyway, okay.
This is Till. And towards the end of the pandemic years in Melbourne, she just leaves. She's done. She's through. And her plan is to go to Adelaide to stay with her grandmother, to care for her grandmother. And that's kind of her excuse for leaving. I'm going to care for someone, because at the time you weren't meant to travel more than so and so without, for certain reasons, one of which you needed to provide care to someone.
Oh, can I just jump in? Yeah. That's the other brilliant bit in the book. Again, I did love parts of this book.
Yeah.
Where she talks about the 5-kilometre radius and how people weren't sure where that was. I know Jules and I went to a park that was probably when we worked out when we came home 7 kilometres. But she says, like, is someone going to pull me over and say, well, you know, and people actually were pulled over.
Yeah, they were.
But usually you were like 50 kilometres. It wasn't 1 kilometre out of your radius. But that thinking, again, she nails it. She nails the whole COVID.
I think a lot of us had that little radar app on our phones.
Yes.
That like, here's where home is. Here's the ring for 5 kilometres. Here's where I can go within the...
So we'd assume this park was within the 5. We came home and realised, no, it hadn't.
No, it's a bit further out. It's all right. No, you weren't caught. It's fine. Anyway, so Till goes. And then halfway through her road trip, she decides not to go all the way to Adelaide because, you know, what if she makes her grandma sick? What if she has COVID and doesn't know it? All these thoughts through her head. So she stops at this little town, Wirrawee, which is a invented town by Treloar, but very much based on the area where it's set, and other towns that she names are real towns. But this Wirrawee is a town, and it's a little, what we would sort of say, ghost town. It was clearly a town that was fairly well lived in and trafficked at one point. There was a railway stop till squats to begin with in a deserted, ramshackle, falling down railway station, which she eventually buys off the person who owns it. And starts to do up properly so she can stay there. And she decides she'll live here. She likes the town. She'll live here. It's interesting that she likes the town because anyone else coming through the town would be like, why would you even – you can't even stop for coffee. You can't even stop for coffee. The coffee machine doesn't work.
Correct.
But – and I think this reflects really beautifully on who Till is as a person right now. She doesn't want people. She doesn't want interaction. She doesn't want – a lot. She has this very stoic existence happening, which is part of her locking herself away in trauma. So the railway station is perfect. And it's this really wonderful, for me as a reader, like two-thirds of this novel is this just fantastic, complex, nuanced exploration of Till and the town and the people who do live in the town and why they still live there.
Who all take her in, who don't treat her like a stranger.
Yeah, this is not one of those coming to a tiny isolated town and you're, oh, there's something wrong with the people. There's nothing wrong with the people. They're just, I mean, people have issues, but they're just people. And everyone's quite welcoming and solicitous, and some of the older people sort of take her under their wing because they recognise that she's this young woman who's clearly going through some shit. And it's really, really wonderful. And I love Till. Till was this very complex young woman. She did a bunch of stuff where you just shake your head and go, oh, Till.
Well, there's that great moment where she essentially smashes the cop up.
Who's yes. Yeah.
Horrible.
But there's, like, I found myself, and I guess this is why it was really easy to see why the town people did the same thing. I found myself feeling the same way about Till as they did, wanting to help her, wanting to protect her, wanting to encourage her to come out of her trauma, and feeling that sort of emotional engagement with her. It was really interesting. It's quite a different way that I often would emotionally engage with characters in a book, to have this less a peer-to-peer type of thing, but more this wanting to nurture and protect and help. It was just really beautifully done. And I think the way Treloar, her sparse writing, her lack of a lot of, to some extent, a lot of emotional exposition for Till, was really, really effective. And that's the book I was really enjoying and really interested to see where it was going. And then...
So before we get to the then, I just want to just echo that the stuff that the... There's also the stuff about European settlement. That
was really one of the characters, the woman who owns one of the stores that is still left trading in this little town, is a First Nations woman from the area, not quite the same area, but the surrounding area. And she has some things to say.
Yeah, but it's beautifully weaved because it's also about trauma and it's about generational trauma.
Yeah, exactly.
That gets inherited and
what you can try to do to work through that.
So to work through it, correct.
Get past that.
So you're right. That is beautiful. And that stuff did leave an impression on me. So I'm not – so I want to be clear. It's not like – even though I may have stopped – that's why I probably wouldn't have stopped reading because there are these beautiful moments that you just go, okay, that's just sublime.
Yeah.
But then – So the biggest issue – let's say it, let's do it.
Yeah.
Is that the person who stole away E
yep.
returns.
And apparently has been
well, imprisoned for 15 years.
They've been in prison for a while, which is why.
15 years, yeah. I remember.
On an unrelated matter to the abduction of E, E's abductor was never identified correct. Or caught.
And for the last 15 years, for reasons, has held this hatred of Till.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because what Till thinks, which you put down to the way children think, is that the man who took E really wanted her. And if she had gone with him instead, if she'd been brave enough to go with the stranger, then she'd be the one who was dead and not E, and E would be okay.
And that's basically true.
And it ends up being taken away from the way a child looks at the world.
Yeah.
That's actually true. The man was after Till and was upset that he only got the consolation prize, her friend, and has been thinking about her the whole time and has tracked her down somehow. I mean, she is quasi-famous because she was a singer of some note, obviously not too much note because she must have been very young because she's 23 now towards the end of COVID, so she would have only had a very short little
Yeah, and these are the things that – this is where my willing suspension of disbelief –
has somehow managed to track her down to where she is in this town in the middle of nowhere.
She thinks she sees him at points during COVID or something.
Yeah.
And he then stays in where – this is in Melbourne. And he floats around Till's mother because he knows who the mother is, and hears it that she's in Wirrawee and then goes there.
I mean, honestly, your suspension of disbelief requires several cranes.
Correct. But then when he gets there, he doesn't punish Till straight away. He goes and abducts
other ladies.
I don't think he says he's doing this to hurt her.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
He's taking people she cares about.
But again, Till doesn't know what's going on. Just women, and in fact, it could easily have been the cop doing it.
It is. And in fact, the cop did kidnap one of the women. So there's this double. It's like, what the fuck is happening? That there's too much.
It's a town of like eight people where there's one cop who's abducted a woman at one point and strung her up, and then our baddie. He's taken an inspiration from that and is now doing it to other women, and then to only so he can then abduct Till and tell her, "See what I did? Aren't I horrible? And now I'm doing it to you, and you're going to die."
Yeah.
And I just went, "Yeah, okay, you've lost me. You've lost me."
Those elements absolutely lost me too. The first woman going missing and the cop doing it, because the cop has been built up to be this horribly icky character. That's enough. And for Till to be linking that to the abduction of her friend in her head well done. So well done.
Correct.
And I can absolutely buy that. Okay, this tiny little town she happens to stop at is the one that has the horrible psychopathic policeman who, fine, that's your buy-in. I'll buy in with that's fine. But her the former abductor tracking her down, her being the one who got away for this person and him being able to find her where she is.
And then taunt her about where he buried her, and it's just
– When I said the book sort of became a different book, that's what I mean. Like, it turned from being this really wonderful story in a bell jar almost, which is this town and this exploration of the town and Till and how people interact with each other and trauma and how people try to work through and pass that without forgetting it. And there's so many wonderful things, like her singing voice. She sings in the way she imagines E might have sung if E got to grow up. And there's just these beautiful, beautiful things. And I didn't need or want the over-the-top crime stuff coming in. Treloar could have stopped with the horrible cop who abducted the person and finding the person, all of that, like doing all of that, fantastic.
But Kirsten, the part of the problem why I call it an afterthought is that it's done sporadically. For a good chunk of the night, it is there, this element, and it's done, it just sort of blips in, blips out, and you even forget that there's this sort of...
I think that's fine though, because that is what happens. Like,
yeah, that's fine if it's
go on
consistently
with their lives.
Done like... No. It's fine if it's consistently done like throughout the novel, but then when it becomes... Everything gets pushed away for that because you have to resolve it.
Yeah.
Although there was no need to resolve
it. And her mother coming to –
yes.
It's just, that whole resolution, it just felt – for the type of book that it had been so far, that just felt too big for what this story was. And it just blew everything away. All the really nice, beautiful stuff was just like, oh, never mind about that. Now we've got this big dramatic crime thing happening. I don't care. And that's probably what you're saying. It hasn't, the yes. book hasn't built up enough
it hasn't,
to make
correct.
You care about that.
It, correct. It hasn't done enough in the early parts to justify that. I just read P.D. James, The Children of Men. And that's a book about trauma as well. I mean, I know it's about the dystopia and the babies. But it's about the main character's dealing with the trauma of the loss of his daughter, who he actually killed. He ran over.
Yeah.
So that's pretty, pretty dark. Yeah. And that trauma. But where P.D. James is just a genius is that all the thriller bits are beautifully aligned with the more literary and the darker PTSD stuff. And it's just beautifully done throughout the whole novel. Whereas he – and look, it's not – it's you can't compare those two books, even though I just did. And that's a terrible thing. But the only reason I say it is because here it doesn't have that same – it's so sporadic to begin with that when it does get lumped on you at the end, you go, what – like you said it perfectly. It's like another book. What have I just – what's going on? It woke me up though. It did wake me up. Now, you said that she does mention her name, and I'd actually –
Yeah. So one of the things which was so interesting to me throughout the whole book and just pulled me through all the time, and I every time it happened, I was like, oh, what is it? Who is this? Who is this? It's the narrator of the book.
Yes.
So the book is written ostensibly in third person direct from Till. We don't get other points of view in the book. It's Till's point of view. And you think it's third person direct. And then I'll read you the whole paragraph. It was the beginning of her leaving. It was when she decided, I mean. There was another thing that happened before Till's flight and exile. I'll say more about that, I suppose. I will have to. She felt too foolish to talk about what she'd seen. Spoken words would make it real and people would say blah, blah, blah. But it's these two little first-person sentences. It's like, oh, who's the I? Yeah,
who's the I?
Oh, that's interesting. And I was chopping and changing all the way through. Is this the like an authorial narrating voice? And I thought that's really interesting. The author in in inverted commas. I'm not saying it's Lucy Trelaw, but the narrator of the book, like jumping in with these little asides and commentaries. Like that is really really interesting. And I was like, oh, is it though? Oh, maybe it's E who's coming along, like is this book being narrated by the ghost of the girl who was killed? And these little things, it wasn't overdone. It was just these enticing little things all the way through. And it was just really, really cool and really interesting. And that is something that was just these wonderful, for me, very pleasurable little things I was thinking about the whole way through the books. And there was amusing ones too. Like there's something where a song was talked about and the I voice says, I can't give you a song lyric because, you know, copyright, but you can look this up on the internet if you need to.
Oh, and there's also the one where she mentions the book that that Till's reading, which is the Julie Phillips Disappeared Earth book, which is another thing that I know a lot of people were reading during lockdown. Anyway, keep going. Yeah, but
and so she'll have these little asides, and there's one which mentions, oh, I've put this in an appendix for you at the end of the novel, and it's there. Like it's this. So it's like, is it the author of the book? Like what? This is so cool and weird, and I'm really enjoying this, and I've not quite seen a narrational style like this before in done in quite this way. And then again, spoilers. By the end of the book, what is revealed is this: the narrator of the book is actually Till's alter ego. The narrator is Till before she became Till. It's her, I guess, her shadow self that she's tried to push away, that she escaped by renaming, and this self has been with her whole life, watching, observing, understanding why she does things, why she thinks things, even though Till doesn't have a conscious understanding of why she's thinking or doing things. And it is just the most brilliant, honestly brilliant way. And if you went back and read the book, I think, which I probably won't have time to do, just the idea, though, when you think about it in retrospect, of Till being two people and the narrator of the book, the I voice of the book, is this self that never got to really go into the light and become a person and has always been pushed into the shadows. And this is the narrator who's describing this other version of herself throughout the whole book, and it is just amazing.
Does the narrator name themselves?
But then the very very, very last chapter, it's like, oh my God, I would have just got rid of it, just kill it, because the it was not necessary, because the last of the book, let me actually, I'm gonna read chapter 29, which is the penultimate chapter of Days of Innocence and Wonder. And it is after all of the events of the book have wrapped up. It's like an epilogal chapter, and it's quite short. So I think I'll read the whole thing. Things a person might wonder in the ongoing ever-present, which is to say in the future, that I, that is the narrator, am the spirit of E, whose ghost has been haunting or protecting or hovering around, curious, until my body was found and my spirit could be set free. That I am the man roaming and pacing, studying Till, documenting her movements, her thinking and her conversations, imagined and actual and considering. People might wonder how I would regard her, Till, with hate, I think, hate and rage. What's new? She's the one who got away. Or am I the grand overseer of Till's world? Come in now, sit in the chair, let me hold you there and I tell you what happened. Or am I the ghost child who went mute, the one before Till, the one who survived, who never went away? I think you might know if you think. Still, even after all this, I'm not sure I can tell you my name. And that tells you who the narrator is. You know it's the ghost child of Till. You know that. And then the last chapter, chapter 30, is one word, Sylvie. It didn't need to be there. She can't tell you her name. She's not ready to tell you her name.
So, yeah, that's right. I must have missed that. Completely.
The end of chapter 29 is just perfect. Here's who all the possibilities that I narrator had been. I'd never thought it was the abductor. Yeah. I was always tossing up between the ghost of Till, or as that second last chapter puts it, the grand overseer, right? Some sort of authorial narratal voice who's
which is what I thought it was, more so like a Kurt Vonnegut type situation.
Yeah. So there were the two I was switching between. And I hadn't thought, oh, it's Till, as you know, before Till. But ending that chapter 29 with that and saying, I think if you think about it, you'll know who the narrator is, and I don't think I can tell you my name, even though.
Yeah.
Perfect, 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 perfect ending.
And then,
so
gives
good.
And then gives the name.
And then chapter 30 is the name. It's like, oh. There's so much I love about this book. There is so little I don't like, and the little that I don't like is that the convoluted crime plot element which was put in, which is not necessary to tell the story of how Till gets through trauma. I mean, how more powerful a story is, rather than I've been able to vanquish the guy I've been afraid of for 18 years, who killed my best friend when I was 5. And the vanquishing of that actual person has enabled me now to begin to work through my trauma. That's one story. That's not what happens most of the time in real life. And when it does happen in real life, it usually doesn't enable you to. It just makes more trauma.
Just creates more trauma.
How more powerful a story would it be to have Till come to a point where she can begin to work through this trauma?
With the people she's met, the community she's created.
Without knowing
now love
who the guy was who kidnapped her best friend. And to get to the point where she can stop blaming herself for everything that happened to E.
Yeah, and if Trelaw wanted a genre element, the cop was enough. I mean, what the cop
did and tried to do to Till and did actually do to the woman
Correct.
Who was assaulted with, that's enough. And that's also enough of an impetus of Till having fixed something.
Yeah, help someone. Couldn't help E because she was only 5 years old. I agree.
To maybe put her, I just feel like, oh my goodness, if there was, I'm not going to try to rewrite books for authors who aren't me, but oh gosh, if you just took out these couple of things, it would be such a near perfect book. And it is still a really good book. I absolutely recommend
I still had the soap issue, so I would have had to read it.
But as you say, may have been your mindset at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've all done that. We've all read a book and gone, oh, this is just, ugh, I'm not feeling it. And it's you more than the book.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yes. And again, I think I've said this, I may have said this in the Lost podcast, or may have been two podcasts ago, where the two of us have read enough now that we know when a book is good. Even if we're not connecting to it, we know this is a good book. It's 100%. Just us.
We've had this discussions a lot in the the second, the rebooting of the podcast over the last few years since COVID, we've had that discussion a lot, that we can see, like I can see The Glutton by A.K. Blakemore is an objectively good book.
Yep.
It's not a book for me in any way, shape or form. And that is not a criticism of the book. I had other criticisms. I spoke about them. But I am not saying it's a bad book. It is an objectively good book. It's not a book for me. This book by Lucy Treloar was almost, most of it was a book for me. It's a book for me. It just had some structural issues. I'm just so puzzled as to why they're there. It's almost like the book thought it needed to reach for something a bit with higher stakes so readers would be more engaged. And I know for me as a reader who's just turned 50, low stakes are enough for me. I don't need world stakes. I don't need stakes that impact me. I need stakes that are tremendously high for the people I'm reading about. And this book had them, didn't need the abductor coming back at the end. It had enough stakes, more than enough stakes.
Let's leave it on that because that's a perfect way of summing up that book and both books in a way. So that's it.
That is it.
That's it. We're sorry, guys. If you love this podcast and it's been with you and it's been with us for a long time, we're sorry.
It has. I'm part of me is genuinely very sad, but also a bigger part of me is quite relieved to not have all of the homework in my life that this podcast has generated.
Yeah, and look, I want to thank you, Kirsten, because as you said, you've done the bulk of the work. All I've done is read the books. Sometimes come prepared and sat in this chair and babbled in my slightly high-pitched voice, whereas you've done the editing because you've had to cut out a lot of shit. Some of it litigious.
Indeed, over the years. Correct. Oh, my God. The podcast masters, I think I need to lock up and put in a safe somewhere.
And you've done all the show notes and done everything else. So, and you've curated it beautifully. So you should be thanked.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
it. If I was with you, I'd give you the proverbial bunch of flowers that you mentioned. Or a box of chocolates.
And we want to thank our listeners.
Yes, absolutely.
For everyone who's come along with us over the years, dropped in, dropped out, however you've listened to this podcast, however you may still listen to this podcast. Some of you may find it after we have stopped our recordings. We will keep it archived on Podbean for as long as what's left of the Patreon money remains.
It may be longer. If we do run out, I'll...
Or maybe I'll find another place for the podcast to live. I might maybe put on the back end of my website or something with some links that people can have a look at. I'll think about it. We'll try to keep it alive on the internet for as long as we can. But thank you, listeners, and thank you. Huge, big, special thank yous to the people who have sponsored us on Patreon over the years. It has made a difference. There have been various costs in regards to this podcast, and you folks have covered all of them and then some, because we now have some money left over to keep the hosting fees going for a few years. But thank you to everybody. Thank you to the authors whose books we've reviewed and loved and sometimes not loved so much, but that's what reviewing is. And thank you to you, Ian, because you've given me books that I would never have come across.
And you've done the same, Kirsten. You've done the same. That's been what's great.
I think you are a much wider reader than I am and have been for the last few years in your locus capacity. So I will have to keep following your blog as well, so I keep getting recommended books that I like, that I think I should read, even though I would not have come across them myself. So
I will say this, if you're looking for a book podcast, now that we're gone, although if you haven't heard of this one, I'd be surprised, but if you are looking for a backlisted podcast, is the best on the web.
We have mentioned that a couple of times.
I mean, that's how we got to the Celia Dale as well. It wasn't just Ben Peake. Andy Miller from that podcast spoke about it.
And a podcast I've been listening to, an Australian podcast, is called The Garret, which interviews an Australian author every episode, usually an author who's had a recent-ish book, and they go for about half an hour each episode, so they're nice and short, and it's talking to an author about their book and much broader things beside. Very good podcast. So I'll put a link to The Garret and Backlisted in the show notes as well. But yeah, this is right. Goodbye.
Let's not drag it out.
No.
Let's not, no.
Thank you all again. It's been lovely doing this, and Ian and I are both looking forward to having wee bit more time in our lives.
Yes. Thank you all. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You don't know the horrible sound of just getting out of the shower and just hearing going, oh God, there's a cat vomiting somewhere.
Children puking isn't great either, although they're
old enough to clean it up after themselves, yours are. Maybe correct. Not well, but.
No, they can, you are correct.
My cats are just like, there you go.
So they just deposit the vomit for you and say, please, clean, thanks.
It was okay this morning because she'd got it completely on the tiles. Very often it's on a bit of rug or carpet right next to the tiles.
So what do they vomit?
This is the best thing. This morning, sometimes they eat their food too quick and it just comes back up. But the best thing, and yes, listeners, if I put this on, I do have the ergonomic bowls, but sometimes they still eat too quickly. But this morning's was fantastic. This morning's was just, I will go outside and I will eat grass and then I'll come back in and I'll throw up the grass.
How old are your cats?
Oh, they will be 8 this year.
Don't they know better?
No. This is being a cat. Part of the agreement that you enter into when you take a cat into your life is the regular cleaning up of cat vomit.